confusion.
He's speaking to me all the time.
Let's challenge his shattered view of the world.
Here's a little action for the never believer. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Obama ditched the pressure. Okay, meet with Hillary, then meet with Bilderberg again. He probably met with Bilderberg before his rally at the Nissan Pavilion. And then he ditched, he put the Obama-loving press corps on a jet plane and just flew him to Chicago while he hanged out to meet with Hillary and meetings. You can hear the guy talking about meetings in Northern Virginia. So let's listen to this closely. Maybe we can get even more clues as to Bilderberg. But this is just, it's just pathetic and it's funny. So here we go. The Obama supporters stranded on a plane. They're snakes. Snakes on a plane. Okay. You can go to revereradio.org. Click on the donate button. Click on the fundraiser button. Anyway. Here we go. Obama press corps trapped on a plane.
Presumptive nominees in the past has always been that they have at least a press pool with them at all times. Is there a reason why we didn't go with him in the motorcade all the way? This is what we're out here for, and now we're on this plane with no candidate.
Again, I understand that there was a desire to do these meetings, obviously, in private, and, you know, that's what we're doing here tonight, but it wasn't an attempt to deceive in any way. It's just private meetings.
The position of the press corps when there is a general election candidate, and right now it is a general election, is that they're treated the same way the president is. If the president goes bike riding, we go with him. If he goes out to dinner or goes to visit a friend three blocks up the road, we go with him in the motorcade.
Right.
And, you know, that's the expectation in a general election, and that's the way it's been with previous candidates, John Kerry, George Bush, you know, when he ran. I mean, that's the way it's done. So why are we diverging from that? And, you know, we would have been happy to sit on the runway. We didn't have anything better to do other than do what we're paying to fly this plane for, which is to cover the candidate.
I understand. Again, you know, there was a desire to do some meetings tonight that he was interested in doing and others were interested in doing, and to do them in a way that was private.
Meetings that were planned the better part of the day, or was this something that was delayed?
No.
What time did they get
out? I don't know the exact time. I don't remember. I don't remember when I got notified exactly of when everything was going to happen.
Before the press left.
At that point, I can go look on my BlackBerry. I don't honestly remember, and I want to make sure that I give you the information.
What about you about a meeting like that? Who notifies you about a meeting like that?
It generally would have been set up in Chicago.
Robert, why were we not told about this meeting and that the senator wouldn't be on our plane until the doors were shut and we were about to taxi to take off?
Again, we had a desire, Senator Obama had a desire to do some meetings. Others had a desire to meet with him tonight in a private way, and that's what we're doing.
We could have sat on the plane and waited for him to come, and at least we would have been in the same city with him. He could have done it privately. We just wouldn't have been in the air during the duration.
I understand.
What's the rationale behind us leaving?
So we can get back to Chicago.
Or benefit. I mean, it's not...
Well, not necessarily my benefit. I mean, my apartment's going to be the same.
We need to be where the candidate is.
Well, maybe it is then for my benefit.
Who made the decision that we were going to leave in a separate plane? Who was the person? I mean, who do we complain to?
That guy looks like me. if there's somebody I can email this off to, I'll be more than happy.
I mean, just to be clear, I think the objection isn't just that he's not fine with us, but that he left his motorcade at all.
I understand your objections, and I will make sure that everyone is aware of that and endeavor to set up a process, as you said, that's more indicative of a general election. A presumptive nominee. I do think there are times when, you know, we're obviously going to do private meetings. But again, we'll endeavor to set up a different process that works and is more amenable for you.
You can tell the media that you're having private meetings, and we'll give them the option of not getting on the plane. You can have a private meeting and still say, we're going to have meetings right now. We're not telling you where these are private meetings.
No, I understand. Look, I don't know. We set up these meetings. They're being done tonight. Again,
is there more than one meeting? Is there more than one person?
I'm not going to get into all the details of the meetings. I don't know that I've got a ton more different answers for all of your questions. I appreciate what you all are saying, and I appreciate we should just pick one of you to email, and I will certainly send all of the grievances along and make sure that whether it's giving, if this, having somebody with him, having, you know, not leaving, giving people the option to leave, all of those different options as a way of in the future.
But since it is the Sabbath, we are going to keep the Sabbath holy, and we are going to hear from our spiritual guru, Pastor James David Madden, up in Harlem. We'll be back.
I am Pastor James David Manning of Outlaw World Ministries, here to present to you today the first annual America's National Bigots Awards. Now, the awards that will be handed out today to persons and institutions, all of these persons and institutions are closely associated with and awarded because of their relationship with Mr. Barack Hussein Obama. Now, without further ado, let us get right to the awards, starting at award number 7 through number 1. Well, the first award on the 7th category today goes to a news reporter of mediocre status named Tim Russert. He is a news reporter for the MSNBC network, who is at best a mediocre, as stated, a reporter, but has a fond relationship, spiritual, with Mr. Barack Hussein Obama. He is the seventh biggest bigot in America today. Moving right along to category number 6 goes to Mr. Jack Cafferty of the CNN news gathering network. Mr. Cafferty is a poor white, poorly dressed, shabbily attired sidekick of Mr. Wolf Blitzer on the CNN news network, perhaps one of the most insignificant reporters in American journalism today. But Mr. Cafferty, who is probably the least desired person on this planet, has tried to make himself of importance by aligning himself and giving all kinds of prejudicial and biased reporting in favor of Mr. Barack Hussein Obama. And for his cheap shots and his patronizing and seeking to uplift his poor white status to something of credibility before the American public, Mr. Jack Cafferty gets award number 6. Moving right along today in America's National Bigots Award Ceremony, Mr. Howard Dean, Democratic candidate for presidency an election ago, gets award number 5. If you remember Mr. Howard Dean's scream when he was off of his Thorazine, Mr. Howard Dean forgot to take his Thorazine and at the end of one of the primaries let out a bone-chilling scream, and then he said he was going on to the White House. Well, he didn't quite make it to the White House, but he has made it to the chairmanship of the National Democratic Party, and he, because of his bias and prejudicial actions within that party in favor of Mr. Barack Hussein Obama, he gets national bigot, America's national bigot category number 5. Moving right along to category number 4 is given to North Carolina State Senator and former presidential candidate, Mr. John Edwards, who has lived a double life. He surely knew what he was talking about when he preached about the two Americas, because he lives in the wealthy side and tried to fish out the votes from the poor side. It was a poor fishing expedition. He went fishing for several months and caught absolutely nothing. And I think he caught maybe 19 delegates that he now wishes to give to Mr. Barack Hussein Obama. And he did not do this prior to the North Carolina primary, but sometimes afterwards when it was felt that Hillary Clinton was going to sweep West Virginia and Kentucky like a maid sweeping a hotel room with a large-scale broom. Mr. John Edwards then rushed to the side of Mr. Barack Hussein Obama and handed over himself to the campaign in terms of an endorsement. So for Senator John Edwards' hypocritical support of Mr. Barack Hussein Obama, he gets America's National Bigot Award number 4. Moving right along. Now, award number 3 goes to a Democrat, a junior senator from Pennsylvania named Bob Casey. This representative of Pennsylvania, who gave his full support to Mr. Barack Hussein Obama, not because he thought that Mr. Obama was the best choice for president, because his teeny boppy daughters, who felt that Obama was cute, and they, his young teeny bopper daughters, had a crush on Obama, and they said, "Daddy, will you go forward and endorse Obama so all of our friends at school can see that we have got girl power of the Casey girls?" And Bob Casey trotted right out and endorsed Obama. But in the district where Mr. Casey's home base is, that district voted 71% for Hillary Clinton. So Mr. Casey, for his poor judgment and trying to give his daughters girl power, Mr. Casey gets America's Bigot Award number 3. Moving right along to America's National Bigot Award number 2 goes to, guess who? Senator, elder statesman Robert Byrd of West Virginia. Mr. Robert Byrd, who once called the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was at the time a Nobel Peace Prize winner, a statesman and great humanitarian, this elder statesman, Robert Byrd, called Dr. King a communist and an agitator and a coward. A communist agitating coward are the words that flowed from Senator of West Virginia Robert Byrd's lips regarding his opinion of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. shortly before his death. Now, what Senator Robert Byrd is trying to accomplish, he realized he's near time of kicking the bucket, And he's trying to whitewash his racist Ku Klux Klan membership heritage. He's trying to burn the sheet that he once wore when he was a Ku Klux Klan by coming out now in a patronizing way and endorsing Senator Barack Hussein Obama. And this is after, mind you, this is after the West Virginia primary, where Hillary Clinton swept that state with more than 42% of the people, 42% of the vote of the people of West Virginia that Senator Byrd represents. He then came out and nullified that 42% vote and turned his allegiance and endorsement over to Barack Hussein Obama. What a first-class bigot, former Klansman, one who called Dr. King a communist coward agitator. Now, before his death, he wants to have a mule train funeral in Washington, so he wants blacks and whites to come. You are nothing but a second-class, pardon me, bigot, Senator Robert Byrd. Now, for bigot, America's National Bigot Award number one. We should have a drum roll at this point that we might recognize who is America's biggest bigot with relationship to Mr. Barack Hussein Obama. Well, got a little surprise for you today. The first prize does not go to a person, but goes to an institution. And the institution that has won, hands down, first prize in being the most patronizing bigot in terms of its support of the candidacy for presidency of Mr. Barack Hussein Obama is the, guess what, CNN News Network. And as a special award to them in this ceremony today, we're going to rename CNN the Cable Negro News, because they are all Negro reporting all of the time for Barack Hussein Obama. So there you have it, my friends. I am Pastor James David Manning, signing off of America's first annual National Bigots Award.
Peace, everyone. Pastor James David Manning here today to give you an update on the American presidential campaign. And update number one, for many of you that are standing with me throughout this process, is the return of Reverend Dr. Jeremiah Wright to the Trinity United Church of Christ there in Chicago, Illinois. And let me tell you why he has returned. He has returned with a vengeance and for revenge. The way he has been kicked under the bus and scorned by Senator Barack Obama, the Reverend Wright feels that he has been treated like less than dirt. And he's back for vengeance. But I think the thing that's most telling about his return and what will happen and how he's going to affect the downfall of Senator Obama is that when Father Flager of the Catholic Faith Church there in Chicago, Illinois, addressed in the pulpit there, the Trinity Church, and began to praise Obama for his skills and to curse Senator Clinton, the congregation went wild. And let me tell you what's wrong with that. What is wrong with that? Senator Obama had recently kicked the entire church under the bus by resigning, he said, for reasons that were good for the congregation and for the Reverend Otis Moss, and that he's no longer associated with the church, so he's left both the church and his relationship with the good Reverend Dr. Jeremiah Wright. Now, any pastor will tell you that when you get dissed by a member the way Senator Obama dissed his pastor, Dr. Wright, the church should then turn and align itself with the pastor and not with the member. But it looks like the members, the 8,000 members of the Trinity United Church, has aligned themselves with Senator Obama. That has ticked Dr. Wright off, in addition to the fact that he was planning his revenge against Obama for Obama dissing him when he made his announcement to run for president. And that's what it was all about at the Washington National Press Club and at the NAACP meeting out in Detroit a few months ago. Just wanted to remind you of that. And what it says, in essence, my friends, is that even though Dr. Wright had been the pastor of the Trinity United Church of Christ for nearly 37 years, the people turned on him and showed him no loyalty, no fidelity, and no integrity. And I just want to say to all of white America, that is what a large segment of African Americans will do. They will turn on you in a heartbeat. After this man had been their pastor, blessed their babies, buried their dead, married their children, they turned on him for Obama, a member rather than the pastor. As Oprah Winfrey turned on white women all over the world, as African-American people turned on the Clintons, so now Dr. Wright has been turned on by his own congregation. He's back now to take the helm, to try to put some strength and truth in this matter as he now proceeds to do his job of causing the downfall of Senator Obama. And before I conclude today with this brief update, I want to also remind you that Senator Obama has promised the vice presidency to Bill Richardson of New Mexico and to Senator John Edwards of North Carolina. So it's going to be interesting to watch over the summer how he dances out of promising high offices to more than one person as he was clamoring to steal the nomination from Hillary Clinton. And by the way, finally, that was one of the greatest hijackings I've ever seen. The great train robbery could not compare to the way the Democratic Party and Barack Obama hijacked the election, of the nomination, rather, from Hillary Clinton. And I would say to all Hillary Clinton supporters, maybe you would tell her, just hold on to your delegates and hold on to your 18 million votes and see, run on to see what the end will be. I am Pastor James David Manning signing off on these brief updates. We will
all right,
be back.
Thank you
to
so
keep
much,
you posted.
Pastor James David Manning. And of course, Pastor Manning concluded his monologue by mentioning the hijacking, the final coup de grace hijacking by Obama, the Obama network of the Democrat Party from Hillary Clinton. And there's an item that was on the Los Angeles Times website. Hillary Clinton's brother is one unhappy camper. While Democratic honchos sought to untangle the problem caused by the rogue Florida and Michigan primaries, the party was in danger of losing a high-profile vote, that of Tony Rodham, the brother of Hillary Clinton. The Times' Faye Fiore found Rodham sitting in an Irish-themed bar in the Washington Hotel, where the Democratic Rules Committee was grappling with a mess. He was drinking a pint and fuming. "I'm just here to make sure Americans are represented by one vote for every person," he said, parroting the Clinton line that the results in the two states should be reflected in their totality at the Democratic convention. With the Democratic National Committee likely to settle on at some unknown point a different solution that results in fewer delegates for Clinton, Rodham opined, "What the DNC and Chairman Howard Dean are doing is an absolute disgrace. The upshot? Rodham, a self-described yellow dog Democrat all my life, is unsure who he would support in November if Clinton is not the party's standard-bearer. If my sister doesn't end up with the nomination, I gotta take a look at who I'm gonna vote for," he said. "Does that mean," Fiore asked, "Rodham would vote for Republican John McCain?" "I didn't say that. It could be Bob Barr," he said, referring to the Libertarian presidential candidate, who was a House member from Georgia, was a prime player in the impeachment of Rodham's brother-in-law, Bill Clinton. With that, Rodham paid his check and gathered his family. His son, the grandson of California Senator Barbara Boxer, whose Nicole was once married to Rodham, is baby by his second marriage, asleep in a stroller, and his pregnant wife. They headed back toward the committee meeting. I'm going to go yell at the DNC meeting or wherever they'll let me in, he said. So there you have it. Hillary Clinton's family backing Bob Barr over Obama. I guess speaking of Bob Barr, he was interviewed by the hard-hitting reporter Stephen Colbert earlier this week. So let's listen to that. And
John McCain's drive to the White House isn't going to be easy. And not just because he never goes more than 35 miles per hour. Tragically, we are nearing the end of the Democralypse. But we are approaching something far more sinister, the Republicageddon. The graphic isn't done yet. The digital wizards over at Lucasfilm are still rendering John McCain's crystal skull. Of course, I'm talking about the Libertarians, a party that wants to shrink down government so small that it can be injected into Martin Short. Libertarians are a widely varied group whose members range from this to this. I don't want Congress to take my gold! Full disclosure, folks, I myself am a libertarian. I don't want big government to infringe on my right to tell other people how to live. And we libertarians are finally having our moment in the sun. This is the year that many believe libertarians will, quote, hold some serious sway in American politics. And we'll use that power to fulfill our dream of eliminating maximum occupancy rules in elevators and suggested age ranges on board games. If I want my three-year-old to play Gnipkanop, he's going to. Choking hazard. In the past, most libertarians voted with the Republicans or anyone else who was willing to end the tyranny of the FDA and drink lead paint. But now they may leave John McCain and support the official libertarian candidate, former Republican Congressman Bob Barr. No.
Barr.
No, not Babar. Bob Barr. Bob Barr has a long libertarian voting record. In Congress, he supported such privacy-friendly, small government initiatives as the Defense of Marriage Act, which made the government small enough to fit into a bedroom. So, what effect will Bob Barr have on the 2008 election? Here to talk about that is an expert on the Bob Barr effect, Libertarian presidential nominee, Bob Barr. Congressman Barr? Thank you so much, please.
Thank you.
Have a seat. Now, sir, let's get right to it here. In a Sunday New York Times this past week, David Boaz of the Cato Institute said, Libertarians are a big swing vote this time. Why is that?
We're a big swing vote this time because Americans are finally realizing, at long last, that the current two-party system, the Democrats and the Republicans, have failed them, failed miserably, and simply will give them more of the same.
Libertarians usually vote with the Republican Party. Why don't they vote for the Libertarian Party?
Well, we haven't had a good candidate. This year is different. We do have a good candidate. The dynamics are shaping up so that this year, particularly with a lot of younger people who are completely fed up with the system, they see the corruption of the system that has given us bigger government no matter which party is in charge. They see the future is fairly bleak, shall we say, under the current system. And they're going to get out there and they're going to vote Libertarian for the very first time. They have a platform and we have a candidate. Someone named Bob Barr that can really do that.
Oh, yeah, I heard about him. Yeah. Now, some have compared you to Ralph Nader in that you might be a spoiler for McCain. What's the difference between you and Nader other than the fact that you evidently own a comb?
Well, and a mustache.
Yeah,
important difference.
Okay. Good point. You have a mustache. Now, is that one of the reasons why you became so anti-government? Were you afraid that the government would make you register that thing?
No.
Because it is clearly a lady killer.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Now, what's the difference this year, I mean, there are all sorts of differences between me and Ralph Nader, but more important than the differences between me and Ralph Nader is the fact that for the very first time, the people see that they really have a choice, and they intend to exercise it.
Now, you're a big advocate of personal privacy. Is that why you voted for the Patriot Act?
Voted for the Patriot Act, not because of that, but certainly, I've come to realize, as many members of Congress did who voted for it, based on a number of promises that were given to us by the Bush administration at the highest level, shall we say, we realized very quickly those promises meant nothing. They went back on everything they told us they would do with the Patriot Act, use it for cases that had nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism. They sought to expand it, yada, yada, yada. And what I've been trying to do over the last 5 years is to try and undo the Patriot Act, and I would do that as president.
You've accused the Republicans in the Bush administration of actually being big government, right?
They are big government with
but
a big D
I
and
disagree
a big G.
Because President Bush worked very hard to reduce the government down to one person, him.
Well, and it takes a big man to do that.
Yeah. But why your disillusionment with the Republican Party? You are a staunch, leading conservative Republican. You led the impeachment fight against President Clinton. I mean, that was a bold, brave moment for America. Why would you walk away from that legacy?
Well, I don't walk away from that legacy. What happened was the Republican Party walked away from its own legacy. You know, it left us libertarian-leaning Republicans and true conservative Republicans in the dust by expanding government and taking away personal freedom.
But you supported the Defense of Marriage Act. You were against the legalization of medical marijuana. Now you work for the Marijuana Policy Project, which is dedicated to legalizing marijuana. Did someone slip you a hash brownie? What has happened to you?
Well, I do like brownies. I don't know whether it had hash in it or not, but I'll tell you what I have seen.
There's an easy way to tell. Did you eat all of them?
I don't remember.
Oh, you don't remember? Then yes, I hate to say. Yes.
No, with a lot of these programs, they have become so large, so oppressive, particularly since 9/11, the spying on American citizens, taking away habeas corpus, and those sorts of things, that we have to go back and re-examine, as I have done in light of a lot of new evidence, for example, that the war on drugs simply is not working. And I think part of leadership is recognizing when something is not working and not stick with it just because that's the way it's always been.
Don't we need to keep our troops in the war on drugs? Because if we withdraw, that's admitting surrender.
Well, what we have to do is we have to recognize that the current war on drugs is not working. Similarly, the war in other parts of the world are not working either. And we have to recognize that. And recognize that we're stewards of a great history and the money of the American taxpayers, and use those funds and that heritage more wisely.
You've upset some conservatives, like Sean Hannity. Aren't you afraid that you're going to wake up with Alan Colmes' head in your bed?
I've awakened with other things in my bed, and that would be pretty scary.
Please come back another time and tell us about those.
Will do.
Bob Barr, thank you so much.
There you go. That was some hard-hitting journalism from the Colbert Report, available on your basic cable system. Anyway, they're talking about politicians doing drugs. The new edition of The Globe, available at finer supermarkets, dated June 16th, has a big headline: Bush on cocaine in White House. Did drugs spark paranoid rages and nearly destroy his marriage? Let's check that out. It is on page 34, Bush cocaine shocker. All right, here we go. This is for the bourgeoisie. Shocking new revelations of drug use raise the prospect that President George W. Bush has abused cocaine, and the mood swings triggered by the drug almost destroyed his marriage to First Lady Laura Bush, sources say. The drug bombshell surfaced in a new book by Bush's former pal and press secretary, Scott McClellan. What happened? Inside the Bush White House and Washington's culture of deception, in which he reveals his suspicions that the president used cocaine. And insiders tell Globe that the use of illegal drugs, coupled with his boozing, could explain Bush's secret rages that have played havoc with his 30-year marriage to Laura. After reading this book, you come away absolutely convinced that George W. Bush has definitely used cocaine, a political insider tells Globe. I don't think there's any doubt. And it raises some pretty serious questions like, was he snorting coke in the White House? It sure as hell would explain those bitter, awful fights he has had throughout the presidency with his wife. McClellan, who served as Bush's press secretary when he was Texas governor and later when he became president, claims in his book that he once heard Bush privately confronted by a supporter about whether he used cocaine. He claims he witnessed Bush, then governor of Texas, offhandedly reply that he couldn't remember, quote, whether I tried it or not. We had some pretty wild parties back in the day, and I just don't remember. McClellan writes, I remember thinking to myself, how can that be? How can someone simply not remember whether or not they used an illegal substance like cocaine? It didn't make a lot of sense. Looking back, McClellan says, it's the first time when I felt I was witnessing Bush convincing himself to believe something that probably was not true, and that deep down he knew was not true. So, in other words, he's a total fucking psychopath. In the years to come, as I work closely with Bush, I would come to believe that sometimes he convinces himself to believe what suits his needs at the moment. Other alarming rumors of illegal drug use have dogged Bush throughout his life. Kitty Kelly quoted former sister-in-law Sharon Bush as saying that he did coke at Camp David when his father was president, and not just once either. Sharon later denied telling the story to Kelly, but another person present that it goes on. It says, or Tom Flacco, I guess some of y'all know who that is, internet reporter. So not too much new in here except that Bush does cocaine is all over the supermarket shelves again, along with, you know, the update on the Kennedy family fighting for Teddy's money. And Priscilla Presley gets a new face, so I don't know that means there's a doppelganger involved or not. We do know there was more than one Elvis Presley. Moving on tonight, why don't we play some music and maybe some promos. By the way, there's a big Revere fundraiser, so go to revereradio.info, and you'll see on most days the chip-in. And just throw some money in. We're trying to get some of those to upgrade their equipment. Here at this do-it-yourself Total Free Speech Network, revereradionetwork.com. You're listening to Total Information Radio, total411.info.
Revere Radio is listener-supported. We need your donations to pay for live internet streaming radio, our toll-free call-in number, and our website, free MP3 archive links, and interactive forums. RevereRadioNetwork.com and click on the Make a Donation button.
And here's some Jello Biafra coming your way.
thing is, years ago, this is about 5 years ago, our institute had a seminar with Martin Fleischmann. Fleischmann and Pons, the inventor and discoverer of cold fusion.
Yeah.
Well, Martin Fleischmann was here in the Washington, D.C. area, and we were able to catch him for a private seminar after he visited the Naval Research Lab. And he gave a nice presentation. We have it on video. The important thing was, after he gets to dinner, then he says, I'll tell you a spook story. You know, not on camera, off camera. And I relate it in my book, the Electrobitics book, actually the Zero Point Energy book as well. And the interesting thing is, this reflects what I believe the black ops are good at. Here he is at the 1989 press conference for the cold fusion at the University of Utah. And he has to fly to San Francisco to catch his plane to England. You know, that's the way the airlines work. And he misses his connection. And he says, so I had to check into a hotel overnight, and as I'm opening the hotel door, the phone rings. And he walks over to the phone to answer it, and guess who's on the other line? He says, this is Edward Teller. Don't hang up. I have a question for you.
Oh, my.
And Edward Teller, of course, is the father of the H-bomb.
He sure
and
is.
Has always been involved in all kinds of stuff, including Area 51, recruiting Bob Lazar, and so forth. So the important thing was he asked the discoverer of cold fusion, can you make a bomb from cold fusion? And Martin is a pacifist. And the way he answered the question was, he says, I gave him an answer that he wasn't expecting, or he wasn't anticipating. In other words, he wanted to say no, even though during his lecture, which we taped, he was explaining the fact that, yes, under high pressure, there can be explosions. And there have been at major labs around the country, at least three of them.
Sure.
But back then, he didn't want to get involved in anything dealing with the explosive applications. So he discouraged Edward Teller from following that route. But this has been a common thread as far as the security, national security applications of anything with a lot of energy to it, or more even a little bit of propulsion or anti-gravity, as we might call it in some circles.
As with so many positions on which Senator McCain hews closely and often precisely with the Bush administration, the senator has tried to finesse the issue of warrantless wiretaps. In our third story in the countdown, finesse no more, with the McCain camp now clearly saying the senator believes what the current president believes, that the president of the U.S. may claim authority to wiretap Americans even where that might directly contravene a federal statute. In other words, the president may break the law using amorphous constitutional power as an excuse. A top advisor to Senator McCain set the record straight in a letter posted online by the Conservative National Review this week. Douglas Holtz Eakin wrote that McCain believes the Constitution gave President Bush the power to order the National Security Agency to monitor America's international phone calls and emails without a warrant. This despite a 1978 federal statute that specifically required court oversight of such surveillance. Furthermore, quoting him, neither the administration nor the telecoms need apologize for actions that most people, except the ACLU and trial lawyers, understand were constitutional and appropriate in the wake of the attacks on September 11, 2001. As for McCain himself, saying about 6 months ago that, quote, I don't think the president has the right to disobey any law, it is notable that in the very same interview, McCain also said, quote, there are some areas where the statutes don't apply, such as the surveillance of overseas communications. Once again, a pleasure to call in Nixon White House counsel John Dean, columnist now at findlaw.com and author of Broken Governments and Worse Than Watergate. John, good evening.
Good evening, Keith.
This advisor also made clear that Mr. McCain, if he becomes president, would call on the telecoms again as necessary, citing, of course, the ever-present terrorist threat, claiming presidential power based on Article 2 in the Constitution. So just to be clear, do you see any daylight between President Bush's position on this and Senator McCain's?
No daylights whatsoever. In fact, it's quite striking. Both men have adopted a position that Article 2 really gives the Commander-in-Chief unlimited powers, and McCain is just echoing what Bush and Cheney have set up and been undertaking for the last 8 years almost now. So there is no daylight.
A volunteer lawyer for the senator had told a computer conference, that McCain wanted to impose some conditions on the proposed telecom immunity that still sits out there as a possibility. The McCain campaign promptly issued a statement saying he was mistaken in saying that there were going to be any conditions on telecom immunity. Does this indicate that McCain is, in fact, going to play the same terror card in this election that we saw Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney play in 2004, that we saw the Republicans play against the senatorial candidates and the congressional candidates in 2002 and 2006?
It certainly does hint at that. These obviously are the pilot fish of the campaign, the pilot fish being those who follow the shark and feed off the main dish that the shark is not inclined to take, and also testing the water and flapping around in the water. So this is some sign of where this campaign is going to go, and it's not a pretty place they're headed.
The senator in this, did he miss an opportunity because he could have said, I will do everything necessary to monitor possible terrorist communications from inside this country to outside of it, or vice versa? I will use the laws already on the books because those laws are more than sufficient. Why is that just a lost opportunity for the sake of humoring the rest of us even?
Well, you know, that obviously would have been to reach a broad audience, to reach a rather intelligent audience. He's playing to an emotional audience, his base. He's taking the hard line. So he didn't choose the high road. He's taking the same route that Bush and Cheney took. And again, it's more evidence of where he's headed with his campaign.
Is there any other explanation, John, for this? Because it's so obvious that with a FISA court that gives you this huge window of doing whatever you want in terms of warrant-free wiretapping, and after the fact going in, when you've already done it, after the fact going in and asking for the warrant, with that great latitude and the fact that the FISA courts have some phenomenal percentage of granting these requests that you don't even have to make in advance, there seems to be no other conclusion than that to go in some other route is specifically to make it look worse than it is and to suggest that somebody is holding out in terms of our ability to use the tools that are already there. Is there any other explanation besides pure politics?
Well, there is. It's become a part of the conservative canon to actually enhance the powers of the presidency at every chance you get. This is, of course, 180 degrees away from where traditional conservatives were, but now the radical right has indeed made the presidency the leading element of the federal government. It's an elected plebiscite every 4 years, they see, where we get a monarch in there who can do pretty much what he wants to do. So he's really just carrying on in this same tradition, this being one of the reasons I think the government's so severely broken and discouraged by where McCain's taking his campaign.
And to that point, lastly again, McCain has made a big deal, having sensed this need for change and this urgency for change on the part of the electorate. He's made a big deal about distancing himself from Bush and at the same time from Obama, and saying, I'm the guy for real change and good change. And at the same time, he's doing this, which is no change whatsoever, involving invasion of privacy, and he voted against limiting the CIA to the interrogation techniques approved in the Army Field Manual. Where is the change per se?
Well, I have trouble finding it. It's certainly not a change that most people who would understand that word in its common meaning would appreciate. He's clearly using this as campaign rhetoric. He's appealing to the emotions of people who want to see a president who is on the beat, 24 hours a day, 24/7, fighting terrorism, when terrorism isn't indeed the largest issue facing this country anymore. So I don't understand why he keeps pushing the campaign in this direction, notwithstanding his words to the contrary, which he, I guess, hopes people will believe, indeed, that he will bring change, and he is a candidate of change, which doesn't bear out, though.
Well, it may be Jay Leno's joke that what he's talking about is he favors change, nickels, dimes, quarters, half dollars. John Dean, the author of Broken Government, Worse Than Watergate. As always, sir, great thanks. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Keith.
And we are back, live on Revere Radio Network, the worldwide home of free speech. So we heard after Jello Biafra, we had a discussion with Keith Orbelman and John Dean about how John McCain is taking the pro illegally wiretap everybody with the NSA position that the Bush administration is taking.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of the September 11th terror attacks, is due before a military judge Thursday. A Marine colonel is scheduled to preside over an arraignment for Mohammed and four others charged in the attacks. The military says it expects the hearing to be confrontational, with defense lawyers arguing points with prosecutors on behalf of their clients. Mohammed's team of lawyers includes a Navy officer, an Air Force officer, and two civilian attorneys from Idaho. The chief defense counsel for the tribunals says the military commissions are fundamentally flawed. Army Colonel Steve David says defense lawyers will zealously identify and expose each and every flaw. Muhammad and the four others will be arraigned at the same time in the high-tech courthouse. A top tribunal official says the accused will get three pieces of information at the arraignment.
They will be explained their charges. They will have the right to have the charges rescinded, or they will be notified of the charges in one way or the other. They also have the right to waive the reading of the charges if they choose. Secondly, they will be advised of their counsel rights. Those are the counsel rights that I have described to you this evening. Those will be identified to the accused tomorrow morning by Judge Coleman. And then thirdly, they will have the right to enter a plea of guilty or not guilty.
All five of the men are charged with murder in violation of the law of war, conspiracy, attacking civilians, terrorism, and other crimes. They all face the death penalty if convicted. The other defendants are Ramzi bin al-Shib, who is said to have been the main intermediary between the hijackers and al-Qaeda leaders, Ali Abd al-Aziz Ali, a nephew and lieutenant of Muhammad, Mustafa Ahmad al-Hassawi, al-Aziz Ali's assistant, and
the story about the bullshit Gitmo 9/11 trial. And there was a Wire story on this. Let's just pull that up here. It was available on Raw Story. It was about the kind of people that were going to be allowed to watch this trial. Now, you might remember they just thrown the military judge out because, you know, he was actually demanding the prosecution turn over some of their bullshit torture evidence to the defense. Anyway, like the one family member from 9/11 that was allowed to go, of course, is going to be this broad Deborah Burlingame. And she is the sister, I believe, of the purported pilot who crashed into the Pentagon on Flight 77, Charles Burlingame, who in fact was the pilot in drills of crashing planes into the Pentagon. And of course, his daughter was murdered in a very mysterious condo fire. 9/11 families' differing views of justice. This is from CBS News. We must not... Okay. As heard from two close relatives of the 9/11 victims, those families don't view the Guantanamo proceedings the same way. We must not forget that 2,973 people that were so brutally murdered as a result of this conspiracy, said Deborah Burlingame. Her brother Charles is a pilot of AA-77, yeah, bullshit, wasn't even in the flight database, we all know. Wasn't in the BTS database, CBS. Friggin' plane huggers. She was among a handful of observers who witnessed the first round of these military commissions unfold at Guantanamo. Gitmo. Isn't that special? There's a way to be there for him, to witness for him, she said. The five men arraigned this week are accused of planning 9/11. They're all masterminds. I liked how KSM also said he killed JFK in his confession when he was like 12. They're being given a great deal more due process than they deserve, quite frankly, said the horrid she-bitch whose brother allegedly died on 9/11 and who is now thirsting for a police state. The long-delayed commissions are controversial, such as allowing government prosecutors to use hearsay evidence. So it goes on. There's also the matter of hurricanes. And if you've been listening to Revere or the Total Information podcast, you might have caught Dr. Judy Wood, a leading 9/11 researcher. She's been looking into this Hurricane Aaron that we didn't really hear that much about, but it was kind of not far offshore from New York on 9/11. Of course, it's always calmest before the storm, and one thing we all realized on 9/11 was how blue the sky was, which, of course, makes blue screen type of visual graphics effects easier to do, either on your Westcam camera or if you have some kind of plane that could turn sky blue. To follow up on the whole Hurricane Aaron thing, here is a recent discussion about steering hurricanes from scientist Dr. McCamey. So let's check that out.
Katrina formed out of a tropical depression as it came up through the Bahamas. It formed very quickly to become the hurricane that passed across Florida. The standard path for that storm should have been north along the west coast, or along the east coast, much as tropical storm Ophelia is doing now, passing up to the right and then up into the Carolinas. That would be the normal path for that storm, just as Floyd did. Now, all of a sudden, Katrina makes a sharp left turn, runs over Miami, and then makes another left turn. All of the prediction paths of the computers showed it going north after it passed through Miami. It did nothing of the sort. It made another major left turn, headed out south as a very disorganized thunderstorm, and within 30 minutes developed into a Category 3 hurricane. And it moved out westerly across the Gulf of Mexico till it hit about midway, and then it made another sharp right turn and started heading north-northwest up towards Texas border, actually, is where it first started to move to. If you drew a line from its path, it would have hit somewhere in East Texas. So it's moving northwards, and then it's kind of bending towards New Orleans. But even 100 miles offshore, Katrina was headed west, mind you, west of New Orleans. As it moved closer, it made a perfect curve, like a perfect strike pitcher's curveball, directly north towards New Orleans. And, of course, at that point, we all thought New Orleans was toast. At that point, when Katrina made landfall, it made a very sharp right-hand turn, almost 90 degrees, and headed east towards Biloxi, Mississippi. And the reason for that turn was because it went over two of the prime oil refineries that had been missed by Ivan and the other four storms that had been guided into that area over the past year. Five major tropical storms, including hurricanes, moving into that Mobile, Alabama area. But the people guiding the storm knew that the big refineries, the two big ones that needed to be hit, lay just east and south of New Orleans. This storm, Katrina, went dead center over that location. But now understand that as Katrina was a Category 4 pushing Category 5 hurricane 100 miles offshore over New Orleans, even the manipulation of the storm couldn't keep it driving at that rate. It lost power. It was only a Category 2 storm as it actually hit those refineries. And as it hit the left part of the eye, just grazed Lake Pontchartrain, which lies north of New Orleans. If you look at my weather book, this has a lot more detail that the severe storms are driven from the ionosphere, something that just about every NASA conference now is coming to the same conclusion. Gee, isn't that interesting? So if you understand what causes the weather, then weather manipulation is the secondary effect, or the understanding of that. So first of all, HARP was a technique to send radio wave radiation in large volumes into certain areas and concentrated on a certain area. But it really was not that effective. They could do a little bit of weather manipulation. They could somewhat move cloud systems around, but it was not very effective. Back in the mid-90s, I came up with a technique that I took to the Air Force. And now I regret that terribly. It's the same reason why I will not take any technology to these people that would be used to get through the Van Allen belts, because these people use it for devious mechanisms to harm the public. What I did in the mid-90s, I took this to the Air Force and NOAA, and I said, I will give you this for free. It's a technology which will allow us to manipulate storms and drag them away from shorelines that would affect people, and we can diminish the energy in storms using these techniques. Well, what they've done is taken those same techniques, built large laser satellites that are in orbit around the Earth, and these are what are dragging the storms around and pumping up the energy in these storms. What they basically do is they shine a laser And these can be in many different frequencies, and this is what I measured directly last January when I went out into the Pacific, because I knew they were doing this. I knew they were playing with these storms out in the Pacific off the west coast of the United States, and I got up to an altitude of about 40-some thousand feet, about 45,000 feet, and was able to view and capture the satellite manipulation of a storm system as they took it from Oregon and dragged it down towards California. So this was direct, the first direct measurement confirmation that they were manipulating these storms with satellites and the laser beams coming down from satellites.
Okay, thank you. Very much. Very interesting discussion about the lasers. And satellites and lasers, very interesting discussion there. And now, as we often do, we are going to close out the show, unless you want to... Actually, don't jump in while Dr. Paul's on. But here we go. Ron Paul's got something to say this week about the Fed.
Your update is not. Oil prices are on the minds of many Americans as gas hits $4 a gallon and continues to surge. How high can prices go? How can we solve these problems? What or who is to blame? Part of the answer lies in understanding bubbles and monetary inflation, but especially the Federal Reserve System. The Federal Reserve is charged with controlling inflation through interest rate manipulation. However, many fail to realize that creating money, and therefore inflation, is really its only tool. When the Federal Reserve inflates the dollar as drastically as it has in the past few decades, the first users of the newly created money go in search of investments for their dollars. They must invest this money quickly and aggressively before it loses value. This causes certain sectors to expand beyond what would naturally occur in the free market. Eventually, the sector overheats and the bubble bursts. Overinvestment in dot-coms eventually led to a collapse of the NASDAQ. Next, we had the housing bubble, and now we are seeing the price of oil being bid up in the creation of another new bubble. Investors are now looking to commodities like oil for stability and growth as they pool capital out of real estate. This increased demand for investment vehicles related to oil contributes to driving up the price of the actual product. If the Fed continues with its bubble-blowing policies of the past, the new commodities bubble will continue to grow. Gas prices will continue to go up as the value of your dollars go down. We will see an overinvestment in these commodities as solutions are desperately sought for a supply shortage, which is only part of the problem. Make no mistake, though, this is not the free market at work. Government manipulations have added levels of complication and unintended consequences to the marketplace. This is not the time for members of Congress to take political potshots at each other or to imagine that the free market is somehow to blame. This is the time to understand and fix problems. That begins with making sure the decision makers have a firm grasp on the causes of the problems and possible effects on their decisions. This is absolutely crucial if we want to get it right this time. That is why I'm in the process of calling for hearings on Capitol Hill on how the falling value of the dollar affects energy prices. Governments need to get out of the way and let the people get back to work so that we can get our economy back on stable footing. Our destructive regulatory environment, confiscatory tax policies, and managed rather than free trade have chased many businesses overseas. The bottom line is average Americans are being seriously hurt by these flawed policies, and they are not getting good information about the true dynamics at work. The important thing now is to get the diagnosis absolutely correct so we can administer the appropriate treatment and to move on to a healthier economic future. To do this, it's absolutely necessary to address the subject of central banking and fiat money. Thanks for calling this update. A new update is placed on this number, 888.
No problem, Ron Paul.
14, every Monday morning. The written text can be found online
earlier.
www.house.gov/Paul under the heading Texas Straight Talk.
At Mr. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a question for Dr. Al-Jabiri. And this has to do with our withdrawal, because I do believe in time we will have a withdrawal. Whether it's done under a deliberate decision and a wise decision, we will withdraw because eventually we won't be able to afford it. And we're getting close to that. But let's say that tomorrow our government announces that we're coming home and we're going to be home and the troops will be out of Iraq in 6 months. Is that too fast, too slow, or a reasonable length of time for us to leave?
أريد أن نتفق على المبدأ.
I would like for us to agree on the principle first.
التفاصيل نتركها للجهات الفنية العسكرية هي التي تقرر كيفية الانسحاب, آليات الانسحاب. هذا شأن أهل الاختصاص.
Details are to be discussed by the experts, the military. It's their job to figure these things out.
أنا فقط أؤكد على مسألة أن العراق قادر على الدفاع عن نفسه, لا خوف عليه.
I just would like to assert that Iraq is capable to defend itself.
أما يعني تقديراتنا تنسحب خلال 6 أشهر أو سنة أو سنتين, هذا أعتقد ليس من اختصاصنا, هذا اختصاص الجهات الأمنية هي التي تقرر هذه المسألة.
But deciding whether it is within 6 months or a year or more is to be discussed by the experts in the military.
التي تقرر الانسحاب الفوري أو الجدولة أو ما شابه ذلك, لكن كقرار سياسي يجب أن يتم الاتفاق على المبدأ فقط.
So as a political decision, we have to agree first on the principle and then let the military decide on the timetable if there should be one.
أعتقد الاتفاق على المبدأ سيكون عامل مساعد في استقرار الأوضاع في العراق.
Because if we do agree on this principle, that in and of itself will contribute to stability in Iraq.
Okay. I'm disappointed with the answer because what you're saying, it's open-ended, 6 months, year, 2 years, and it seems like it would be much easier to say that militarily it wouldn't take much effort to ask a military person exactly how long it would take to do it. But to say that politically we might need to take a year or a year and a half or two, it doesn't support the position that we need to leave. It just supports the position that we can procrastinate forever. I want to follow up, because I think I got your answer on that. I want to follow up and say, can you give me an idea that if we did make this announcement, even if we accept your position that it could be 6 months or a year, what percent of the Iraqi people would support us leaving in a reasonable time of 6 months plus under the circumstances you described? Is it a small number of people or almost all of them? What percent of the Iraqi people would agree with us leaving under those circumstances?
I ask you to perhaps have a referendum, and that will tell you the truth.
So
you have no idea. You have no idea. Maybe only 5% want to support us leaving. You have to have an idea.
5% شو؟
من الشعب العراقي يوافق الانسحاب ولا
لا؟ لا طبعاً لا, أغلبية السكان مع الانسحاب.
The majority of the people of Iraq are with the withdrawal.
51%.
لا أكثر بكثير, لا ربما يصل إلى حدود 70%.
Perhaps even about 70%.
Okay, that's good.
حسنا.
When we leave, how will it be perceived if we leave the embassy with our presence there in the super embassy of the world? Do we have to deal with that symbolically? Does that rub some people in Iraq the wrong way, that we have the biggest embassy in the world, big as the Vatican? Or do we have to address that subject and say, when we leave, we're going to have a small embassy appropriate for what we should do to have an embassy in that country?
السفارة اللي تؤسس في العراق عدد موظفيها كبير جدا.
The embassy in Iraq has an incredible large amount of staff.
أكيد هي أكبر من حجم المهمة الدبلوماسية الآتية من أجلها.
It is certainly larger than the diplomatic mission for which it has arrived
يعني
for.
معلوماتي تقول أن هنالك 3,000 موظف.
I have information that there may be about 3,000 employees.
فبالتأكيد يعني في يعني ربما رؤية أخرى غير الرؤية اللي نراها.
And there certainly is another view than the one that we see.
وفي تلكؤ الحقيقة في علاقاتها بالمجتمع.
And yes, there is some procrastination in its relationship with the society.
يعني علاقتها محدودة في المنطقة الخضراء.
Because its relations are limited to the green zone.
وحتى في المنطقة الخضراء ليس كلنا لنا علاقات طيبة فيها.
And even within the green zone, not everyone has good relations.
Let me narrow this down. Would it be not good policy for us to keep that embassy that big? Or would you advise, look, when you leave, it's not good for the Americans to have this embassy? Do you think that for public relations reason we should address that? Or do you think it would be an insignificant event for the Iraqi people to maintain that embassy as it stands?
يعني نفس التساؤل اللي أنا أسأله, ما هي الحاجة الدبلوماسية لثلاثة آلاف موظف في العراق؟
This is the same question I ask myself. I mean, why do we need 3,000 employees in an embassy in Iraq?
إذا افترضنا أنها بعثة دبلوماسية مثل أي بعثة في العالم.
If we consider it as a diplomatic mission like any other diplomatic mission.
فشيء طبيعي أنه كل بلد يضع ممثلين. يعني هل بالمقابل ويبدأ معاملة بالمثل, هل يجوز للعراق أن يؤسس
سفارة
من 3,000 موظف في واشنطن؟
So from the principle of reciprocity, would it be appropriate for the Iraqis to establish a 3,000 employee embassy in Washington?
I understand that part, but what I want to know is the emotional public relations reaction to the Iraqi people if we stay there. Do we still have a problem when we have that presence along with military bases, even though we claim we have left? It seems to me that we have to know what leaving really means.
أكيد ليست إشارة إيجابية للشعب العراقي.
It certainly would not be a very positive signal to the Iraqi people.
لو تحتفظون بسفارة معقولة في العراق.
If you maintain a reasonable sized embassy in Iraq.
تقوم بالانفتاح على المجتمع العراقي.
Okay, that would open up to the Iraqi society.
يعني تحافظ على علاقات طيبة. نعم, علاقات طيبة مع المجتمع العراقي.
And have relations with the political elite and the society.
And would you have that same assessment with our military bases?
شو؟
هل تعطونا نفس التقييم من دول الشعب بالنسبة للقواعد؟
القواعد العسكرية بحث آخر.
The military bases are a different story. Diplomatic missions.
إجراء معمول في كل العلاقات الدولية.
Are done in all international relations and there are no problems with it.
النوع على
المستوى. We may have a few differences on the number, on the kind, but that's all. Good for. I mean, we can always negotiate these things.
لكن القواعد العسكرية.
But military bases.
الله السيستاني أيضا أصدر فتوى بضرورة عدم تضمن أي معاهدة لمثل هذا الإجراء.
Even the Ayatollah Sistani has decreed that no agreement or treaty should allow the presence of military bases.
So the answer really is that the people would be less tolerant of the military bases than some embassy. I mean, the argument would be that indeed we need to address the subject of military bases because that is an affront to the Iraqi people. Is that correct?
بالتأكيد, التحسس من القواعد العسكرية.
Yes, there definitely is some resentment for the presence of military bases, not for diplomatic presence.
Right, and therefore we must address the military bases, and I yield back. Thank you.
A man on Mars, and I think that it would excite the imagination of the American people if we could say, hey, look, here's what it looks like. We know that now, and here's what may be there, and let's all join in that project. I think Americans would be very willing to do that, not to mention all the other valuable things that NASA contributes. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to introduce you to two people here for a little bit. First of all, Jeff Peckham, he was just on the program before. He's sponsoring an initiative that would force his hometown of Denver, Colorado, to create an ET commission once voted on, tasked to deal with issues related to the presence of extraterrestrial beings here on Earth. Jeff is organizing the showing of a few clips of video that he captured of an extraterrestrial peering into a window.
So what we have here...
Friday morning in Denver for the media. Press conference not open to the public. Slated for 11 o'clock.
So let's check it out.
Roman
see if it's
been having UFO sightings since the age of 5, and after a UFO encounter in December of 2000, of which he videotaped, Stan says his life has been a living nightmare. Here he is, back on Coast to Coast. Hey, Stan, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good, good. Now, Jeff, give us an update, first of all, on just what the situation is for the initiative and what's going to happen tomorrow.
Okay, we got approval on the petition last Thursday. The petitions were printed on Friday. Then we decided to go ahead and organize something for the different reporters that had been interviewing me about that initiative, because when they asked me what the experiences were that provided the evidence that convinced me to do the initiative, I referred to Stan's videotape of the ET and a lot of the other documentation that he provided, and they all, you know, consistently with great passion demanded, requested to see that video footage as well and some of that other evidence. So we organized that since, you know, up till now. That's going to happen tomorrow. And then after tomorrow is really when we do all the petitioning.
Okay, Stan, tell us a little bit about this video, if you can.
The video actually was captured in Nebraska. I moved to Nebraska from Colorado to, I got married and I wanted to be with my wife. And
well, congratulations there.
Well, this was a long time ago. I've been married 5 years now.
All right.
I thought we had a peeping Tom. I had twin stepdaughters, teenage stepdaughters, and late at night, I'd walk into the kitchen, and our curtains were open, and I'd see this head pop up, and it's like, what in the world? And every time I'd run outside, there would be nothing there. My experiences had been going on for quite a while, and I called one of the researchers, and I said, you know, I think I got a damn peeping Tom. And he said, well, you know, this is what you do. Next time you see it, don't run outside. Turn off all the lights. Loudly say, I'm going to go to bed or something. And set up your video camera and put it on night shot. So I did exactly that. And there were two flashes. I actually went and sat in the bathroom and read a magazine because I wanted to see if I can catch this thing. And I saw two flashes. And after the second flash, I thought, what in the world's going on? And I saw this thing kind of drop down, and I ran to look out the window, and I saw this little, there was a full moon, I saw this little thing running toward the backyard, and I was really, really super surprised to see what I caught on video.
What will your video show, Stan?
It'll show something looking in the window, and it'll show the flashes. And it's definitely not what I expected. It was on night shot, so it was on infrared. It was a Sony camera.
How do you know it's not an animal, Stan? Some kind of strange-looking animal.
When you see it, you can tell it's not an animal. And what's interesting, when I watched this thing run away, it must have been about 4 foot, maybe 4'3" at the tallest. But the window itself was approximately, the bottom of the window was 8 foot off the ground. And there was nothing. It wasn't standing on anything. I don't know how it did what it did.
Spring legs or something. Describe for us, Stan, what it looks like.
Well, big eyes. Not your typical ET-looking kind of thing. It did have a really big head, huge eyes. You can see it blink. You can actually see the reflection of the IR on the or the infrared in its retinas. And it's looking around, and then it pops down, and it pops back up, and kind of drops down and runs away.
Sorry, Stan, were there any reports of UFO activity or anything during this Peeping Tom episode?
No, nothing, nothing. And we were in a small town in Nebraska, so I'm sure if there was any UFO activity, nobody would have reported it for fear of ridicule.
And did the Peeping Tom episode stop?
I think it happened one more time just briefly, and I ran outside, and I ran outside a little bit slower the next time it happened, but after that, yeah, it kind of went away.
Okay, now at this news conference, slated for 11 o'clock, your time on Friday, tomorrow, tell me what the media will see. You're going to show what?
We're going to show... Now, the media is not... Here's the problem. I've got agreements with some of the scientists and researchers involved in this case not to give out anything just yet until I've had a chance to fully go through and do their research and make sure everything's copacetic. We're going to give them a still, and they're going to actually be able to see the video. They can't take any pictures or video of it.
All right, they're going to be able to sit in the news conference as members of the press, as an audience might be in a movie theater, and watch this, right?
That's correct. And this is just one small piece of, I mean, the scientists and researchers involved in my case have put surveillance cameras up all over everywhere. And what they've captured with the surveillance cameras is quite amazing. And this is just one small thing of the whole story. So.
Okay. And you're gonna get us a copy of the still after you release this?
I don't see that there would be a problem.
All right, we'll do that, and then we'll post it on our website and give you, obviously, full credit for this, Stan, and Jeff, you as well. Now, when you said scientists, Stan, are working on something, who are we talking about here?
Well, I can't. Honestly, I wish they'd let me say, but there's, you know, the way we're doing this is we're not going through mainstream ufologists for a reason. We're going through, you know, some fairly decent scientists and very, you know, reputable scientists that are, you know, willing to put their reputation on the line.
So you want them to analyze this?
Well, they have been, and they're coming up with some amazing stuff, but unfortunately I can't mention any names just yet because I have these agreements, and when this comes out, trust me, everybody will know who they are. And everybody
okay.
Will know
well, now, after tomorrow's news conference, when will the other big pack of information come out on this?
Hopefully soon. They're working on it as fast as possible. As soon as they get everything analyzed and everything worked out, then it'll be available. If it were up to me, and thank goodness it's not up to me. I just left it in somebody else's hands. This would have been out a long time ago. But we really want to make sure that there, you know, nobody's trying to pull my leg or their leg or anybody's leg, and that this is the real deal. And in order to do that, it has to have serious scientific, you know,
scrutiny
on it.
Is it possible that whatever was peeking through the window might have been somebody in a little alien costume? Is it possible?
Well, there's going to be, there has been a lot of people looking at these videos. We've got a professional that did an analysis on this. And, you know, one of the things he said is if this was somebody outside, it has to be a very elaborate costume, and it would be in the thousands and thousands of dollars. Now, who in their right mind would do something like that?
Well, and who in their right mind, too, would peek into a house and, too, wear a costume?
Yeah,
I mean, what a perfect way to get shot through the window, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I came out running out there in a baseball bat, and I know I saw this thing run away with my own eyes.
How did it run? Did it hop, skip, jump?
You know,
what?
It had a weird gait. I can't even explain it. It almost like Well, first of all, very lanky, very skinny, and it almost looked like it ran toe to heel, like it might have had a, I don't know how to explain it. It's impossible for me to explain.
Jeff Peckham, what do you think of all this?
Well, it was very convincing to me, but again, I saw that evidence at the end of a 2 or 3 hour presentation by Stan, and by that point, all the other evidence that he had presented had already convinced me. So seeing that image was sort of like, okay, this is the culminating image that puts it all together and fits with everything else that he said. And it was just like the last impression that, you know, sewed up the whole thing for me. I would have already, you know, even if I hadn't seen that, his story is very convincing when you look at all the other scientific evidence, documents that he has. You know, it's just a very, very persuasive story, and that just capped it off.
Well, our friend Matt Drudge thinks enough of the story. He's had it on his website all day. And he's excited about it as well, I'm sure. Stan, have you been approached by government officials, military folks, saying, we want to know what's going on here?
Yeah, I can't tell you if it's government, because I just really don't know. I can't tell you what's going on, because I really don't know. I've been beat up. I've been told to shut up.
What do you mean you've been beat up?
Yeah, I was told to shut up, and they broke my nose and broke my wrist.
Who broke your nose?
I can't tell you, just four guys with...
You can or you won't?
Well, I can't. I can't tell you who they are. I can't tell you if they're military or just some... I can tell you that they were clean cut, clean shaven.
What, did they come to your house and
No, they followed me to work, and I rode my bike to work, and told me to shut up and beat the heck out of me. And there were people driving by calling the police when this happened.
And they got away.
I was fighting back, and they actually tased me, and I hit the ground, and they got away, and the police couldn't do anything. They said it just disappeared. No information about it whatsoever.
Well, and here you go with a major news conference tomorrow. Aren't you a little afraid?
I'm not going to actually be there. Some of the scientists involved in my case are going to be there. I'm always afraid, but you know what? I think they're ready to open this up. I mean, the Vatican just came out with this. All these other, people just come out with this. So
Stanley, at least by sometime Friday, we'll know some of the scientists involved in this if they're going to be at this news conference?
Yes, for sure.
Okay.
And, you know, what's interesting about this case, too, is I haven't had to do anything. It seems like who or whatever they are seem to like to do stuff only when there's a lot of people around. So, hey, better for me.
Dramatic. All right, Jeff Peckman, thank you for your update, and you as well, Stan.
Here's some Dash Rip Rock.
Wander and stray, cause